This is a continuation of the oral history interview with Michael Goldberg, Wisconsin Union Theater Executive Director Emeritus. Today is April 25th, 2006. Michael, we're ready to continue with your work at the Union Theater.
Well, we talked a little bit a little while ago about the students as programmers at the Union Theater.
Right.
And what we talked about was the fact that the students, the Wisconsin Union, as you know from other tapes and from other areas, is really the one of the prototypical college unions. Not archetypical, but prototypical, because in fact, Porter Butts, the first director of the Wisconsin Union, created essentially the college union movement in North America, along with a couple of other colleagues back in the 1920s and early 30s. And one of the essential concepts of this kind of college union is that it is a student-led enterprise.
Right.
So the student programmers at the Wisconsin Union were in fact the programmers. And as we were discussing before, the program staff were kind of mentors and monitors. Students didn't work for the staff. But in the case of the Union Theater, there really was kind of a need for administering the theater in areas that the students really, because of the time lag of being in the current year while this theater's program had to be put together a year and a half out, but also because so much of what the theater did didn't have much to do with students at all. I mean, only a fraction of the programming was student targeted, and realistically, only a very small portion of that could be student produced in the current season. So I did what I could to give the reins of program responsibility and authority over to my student programmers, and I was less at liberty to do that, at least I felt, than some of my colleagues on the program staff, who like the film program. Basically, the students did all the programming. They talked to the agents, they picked the films, they sold the shows and everything else. Similarly, even in the gallery area, the students would jury the exhibits and everything. In the case of the theater, I had to keep things a little closer in my circle of control. And I'm not sure everybody on the program staff agreed with me about that, but that was the experience of my three predecessors at the Union Theater. You know, Ralph Sandler before me, Dawson before him, and Fan Taylor for lo those many years. For better or for worse, I think my student programmers, like others, came away from their Union Theater directorate experience very, very pleased with that experience. I suppose there are exceptions, but most of them, and I am periodically in touch with many of them many years later.
Are you still, Michael?
Leisha Keaton, who was the program, the theater program, the director for the 89-90, which was actually the anniversary year, it was the 50th anniversary. She's a lawyer in Indianapolis. She sends a Christmas card every year. And I always write back and I say, thank you for your holiday, Leisha. You had a good upbringing. She never forgets to send the holiday card. But there are others, too. What's her last name? I know her husband's name now, but I can't remember what her name was. She was from Milwaukee. She went off to California. She pursued a career in acting. She and her husband actually just moved back to Milwaukee. She comes down occasionally. They're looking for work. They're both actors. They've got advertising gigs and other stuff in Milwaukee. Brittany Reed, who was my director the last year I was at the Union, just 6 months ago asked me for some reference letters. She just got admitted. I love this. She's going to school for a PhD in education and in policy, right? So she applied to three schools, I can't remember one of them, the other two were Columbia, Harvard, and I can't remember the third one. Of course, she got into all three. She said, I'll probably go to Harvard because it's Harvard. So she's in touch regularly. And then there are others, too, and I hear from them. And they had a good experience at the Union Theater, and they learned a tremendous amount, and that's very gratifying to me. And some of them, not necessarily the theater directors, although one or two of them too, actually have become colleagues In other words, years later, they went into the arts admin biz. So running the Union Theater was a job for the theater director, but programming the Union Theater really was a collaboration between the director and the student director, the committee members. And in the end, even to the extent that I might have been, you know, exercising a heavy hand in the programming, particularly with the classical music, which the students had, with rare exceptions, limited knowledge and even less interest in. But everything we did programmatically, ultimately, they had to endorse and they had to approve, and they had to take the budgets to the Wisconsin Union Directorate, which approved the budgets, and ultimately to council as well. So regardless of how much baseline input they had into the program content, depending on what the programming was, ultimately everything was done with their agreement and their approval, and they got to say yay or nay. They could have come in one year and said, there will be no concert series next year. We declined to approve a concert series budget. Now, I don't know what kind of pandemonium would have broken out in the campus community, but in fact, in that union environment, that was Porter's concept. The students absolutely had the power and the authority.
Michael, I can't help but think that all those years of working with the program committee, that it honed your negotiating skills. You are this wonderful mixture of charm and decision making.
Yeah.
And you really had to do both, didn't you?
Yeah, there. I'm not sure my wife would agree with you on either of those things. After 25 years of marriage, the charm has worn off, and I've never been very good at decision making at all. But no, it's true to an extent. To the extent that you had to learn to listen, because the mandate was to respond to and be responsive to the students. And I think I told you earlier along in our conversations, you know, we just every year the program staff would plan a training retreat for all the student program. Well, like a lot of people at the university, we would sit down every year and say, well, what do we know about this incoming student class? You know, and every few years they would change. You know, the student class is all selfish. You know, these are the Xers and these are the Yers. And, you know, that little survey that's usually published by Beloit College where they say, students coming to the universities this year, this freshman year, as far as they're concerned, Vietnam happened as long ago as World War II.
Yes.
You know, and they've never seen an LP record. They don't even know what such a thing is. They wouldn't know how to play a record player if they came across one, you know, that kind of thing. You know, they've been barraged by X numbers of advertising messages per minute and so on and so on. So we spent a lot of time trying to kind of, you know, vetting the students to see who we were dealing with year to year. But our responsibility was to follow, not to lead, or to lead by example, but to support them in their own leadership. And, you know, you go around the state of Wisconsin, people who were Wisconsin Union Directorate leaders over the decades have ended up all over the state. I mean, you know, they've been lieutenant governors, they've been, you know, head honchos of this, that, and the other thing. And to a person, as far as I know, they come away and they say, the best thing about my university education were all the things I learned at the Wisconsin Union about becoming a leader, mm-hmm. about becoming a responsible service person in the interest of whatever it is I'm working on. So that's great stuff. But in the end, the theater was many, many things to many, many different people on campus. And because it was kind of a, we talked about it, it's not a magnet exactly, but at some point everybody needed the Union Theater for something. Mm-hmm. Not just coming for a show, but they had to come down there because they needed the kind of services and production capabilities that the Union Theater could provide. So we dealt with everybody at the university, including, of course, the theater and drama department. Now, the theater department's relationship to the Union Theater goes back to way before there was a union theater, but there was a Wisconsin Union. Remember, the union opened in 1928, but the theater opened in 1939.
Right.
One of the premises for creating the Union Theater was to make a home for the concert series, which was sponsored by the Men's Union, going back to the 1920s.
Oh.
But one of the purposes was to make a home for the theater productions that were produced by Wisconsin Players, which was the producing arm of what was then still called the speech department. So if you go back, and I don't know the early history back to the 20s and 30s, but when I got here in 1960, the speech department was really four components. There was theater, you know, making show business. There was dramatic lit. That was the Ronald Mitchells of the world, and the Jonathan Curbs of the world, who also did directing. There was tech and production, and then there was rhetoric and public address. Mm-hmm. Oh no, and I forgot. And there was also, at that time, also communicative disorders, therapy, speech therapy. That's okay. So the speech department was this umbrella.
Yes.
It had a theater component, it had a dramatic lit, rhetoric and public address component, it had speech therapy, really. And it was really only in later years that communicative disorders split off into a creature of its own, and theater and drama became theater and drama department, and I don't know where rhetoric and public address ended up. But in 1939, Fan Taylor was not the first person to be overall in charge of the Union Theater. Her first year, 1939-40, she was technically the marketing or publicity person. And it's a little fuzzy in here because I tried to get this from her, and she's been over the years not totally clear with me about how things were structured there. Maybe my problem is trying to understand what she was saying. But my recollection is that when the theater first opened, somebody in the speech department on the theater faculty was actually the director of the Union Theater, although he wasn't really the director. Fan ran the theater, but she didn't become the director of the Union Theater until 1945-46. She ran it for the first 5 years. Be that as it may, the speech department's producing arm for theater productions was Wisconsin Players. And they have a long and honorable history. And that's what I got connected to when I came to the university in 1960.
Right.
And they had already been producing their shows in the Union Theater since it opened in 1939-40 and all through the 40s and 50s. Because remember, the theater, like everything else at the Wisconsin Union, was supposed to be a laboratory for out-of-classroom learning.
Correct.
So there's an obvious linkage between speech department, Wisconsin Players, and the Wisconsin Union Theater. There was always, in my experience, even going back to the early 1960s when it was most intimately linked, a kind of demarcation between the speech department's connectedness to the Wisconsin Union Theater as their performance venue and the Wisconsin Union Director of Programmers who programmed in the theater. But let me give you an example. In the 1960s, when I was an undergraduate, I was not a theater major, I was an English major, but I worked on theater productions Yes. all the time. Well, every Friday afternoon in the green room in the Union Theater, there would be a coffee hour, like 3-4 o'clock on Fridays, kind of a pre-weekend, end of the week sort of thing. That wasn't the director of kids, although the director of kids would sometimes show up, but a lot of them were the speech department theater majors, the techies and the undergraduates and graduates in the theater department. So the Union Theater was a home for the director of programmer kids, but it was also a home for the theater department theater majors as well. And I can't speak to how they did those things before 1960, but I know when I got there and the pattern was pretty well set, Wisconsin Players did 5 main stage productions a year in the Union Theater between September and May. And 3 productions every summer. And they did studio plays, either student plays or MFA directing projects upstairs in the play circle. So in fact, the theater department had no theater facilities other than the Wisconsin Union Theater. Like the School of Music, the theater department, the speech department faculty were scattered all over campus, hither and yon. They were in all these old buildings on Dayton Street and on Park Street. They had offices here, there, and elsewhere. They had studios. But essentially, for all their production-related work, the Union Theater was it. It was their shop, the Union Theater shop, where they built their scenery, and so on. Now, this is in the 60s. Things changed a little later in the 70s. But in the 60s, that pattern had been in place for a long time.
And successful, I take it.
It was successful for a variety of reasons. Remember, for one thing, there was the inimitable Fred Berkey.
Yes.
Fred was an associate professor. He was the tech theater guy for going back to before the Union Theater opened. But he was also the first technical director of the Wisconsin Union Theater. So he was kind of like the anchor. All the speech department faculty, Jonathan Kervin and those guys, would direct their productions in the Union Theater, or else students would direct them. But mostly it was faculty directing in the theater itself. Union Theater was the speech department's production home. And in fact, Wisconsin Players had a business manager and a business office where they sold their theater tickets and everything. And their office was in the Wisconsin Union Theater. There's a funny little office in the Union Theater, which is on the second floor down the hall from the play circle. As you think you're going out onto the terrace outside the theater.
Yes.
And right in the corner before you go out onto the balcony, there's a little door. And that door opens up on a tiny little stairwell. It can't be more than 3 feet wide. And you go up this tight little winding staircase, and there's an office up there. And that's where Wisconsin Players had their business office. That is now, as I understand it, it's Ted Crabb's office, where Ted still, now that he's retired, he does work for the union he's the secretary. He does ongoing work for the union trustees. Anyway, so the business and the activities of the theater, producing activities of the academia, also had their home in the Union Theater until the 70s. And it was difficult. I mean, scheduling was difficult. They would eat up big chunks of time. They never had as much time as they wanted. Fan Taylor and all the student programs, the directorate wanted these times and those times. They were all blocked out. I've told this story many, many times, but I remember Fan, even when I was an undergraduate, I didn't even really know what the future was about, picking up her calendar on her desk, with those big open calendars with days for 2 years out, right?
Yeah.
And I've told this many times, she would pick up the calendar and clutch it to her bosom, and she would say, "Whatever you do, hang on to this. It's the only real power you have." And controlling that theater calendar, and it was the case when I was a director 25, 30 years later. It was a very powerful position. Not power for its own sake, it's just that everybody had so many pressing needs, and they were all time sensitive, and
yes,
you had to be responsive to that. So anyway, the theater department, the speech department, for all of the command that they had of the calendar, still, you know, you got to be out of here by tomorrow afternoon, because tomorrow night we've got to have a piano concert series event in here, and so on. So Fan kept everything. She kept all the files. She kept every program and document and contract and piece of paper imaginable. Fan used to tell me, you know, don't throw anything away. Just throw it in a file somewhere. You never know what's going to come in handy. So, you know, we kept the files. We kept the files of everything. I'll tell you a quickie story about Fan and the files before we go back to the theater department and the speech, the Wisconsin Players files. Fan, as you know, Fan is now pushing, she's 94 now. She's living out here at Attic Angel on the west side. She's slowing down significantly. Up here, she's still clicking away, but her hearing has deteriorated, and physically, she's just, you know, very, very diminished from the person that she was. She's been living at Attic Angel for about 5 years. Well, about 6 years ago, when she was a mere 88, she called me up, and we would go to lunch every 3-4 months. And she still had her home in Shorewood. And she called me up in August, and she said, let's go to lunch. I have some files, a personal file, that I'm cleaning out the house, and I thought you might want them. Do you think you want them? And I said, well, they're connected to the theater. She said, oh, yeah. I said, well, Fan, you told me never to throw anything away, so of course I want the files. So we went to lunch, and then we went back to her home, and she took me upstairs to a bedroom, which is one of the girls' rooms that she was now using as a study. And on a little ledge is a box of file folders. So I reach in, and I pull out a file. And across the top of the file, it says Indrani, I-N-D-R-A-N-I. Now, Indrani was an Indian dancer who kind of did for Indian dance in North America what Ravi Shankar did for Indian music in North America back in the 60s.
Yeah.
So I pull out this file and I said, Fan, Indrani. I remember the Indrani concert. Here it is. It was 1960-something or other. I said, I was a student stagehand. I worked that show. And Fan says, oh, yeah, Indrani, I was just in that file a couple of weeks ago. And I said, excuse me, you were in your Indrani file a couple of weeks ago? Remember, this is 1997. She says, yeah. It turns out that Indrani had passed away. And there was an obituary in the New York Times. So Fan, very dutifully, clipped the obituary out of the New York Times and put it in her 1962 Indrani file.
That's too good, Michael.
Now talk about keeping up your files. I mean, that was a Fan Taylor moment of great
classic.
Anyway, Fan kept all the files. Well, she also kept program files, which is to say, files of all the printed programs for all the events year after year after year. So she had all of the Wisconsin Players files for all of the performances that they had done in the Union Theater. She didn't have all their detail files. They kept those in their business office, but she had the programs from all the performances they'd done from 1939, when the theater first opened, until 1970-71, when they left for Vilas Hall. She had all their performance programs. And of course, that's how you and I met.
Right.
Well, let me say something about that departure. They left in a hurry, and they left in a huff. They were not happy campers. By the later 60s, things had gotten pretty contentious between the theater department, still called the speech department, I believe, and they might have changed the name by then, and Bill Dawson, who was Fan's successor. They didn't have the production time that they needed. They felt, perhaps legitimately, perhaps not, that the constraints of having to load into and out of the Union Theater inhibited their ability to perform their pedagogical mission as a training ground for theater professionals, right? They didn't have their own spaces. Now, you remember that it was in the late 60s that a new wave of theater department leadership appeared on campus. It was the Yale invasion, led by John Ezell, who was a great, great designer, and some others, and John Wright Stevens, who was another designer who came from Yale. There was Adam Moore. There was a new generation of theater leadership that succeeded Jonathan Curvin, Nordine Ness, and Ron Mitchell, the icons of the 50s, of the 40s and 50s and early 60s. And these guys felt that they were very, very straitjacketed by the limitations of having to do all their work in the Union Theater. And in fact, it was in that period, in the late 60s, that they actually took over a place which came to be called Compass Theater. I don't know if you remember that. It was probably before you even came to Madison.
It was.
Compass Theater is on the corner of Old University Avenue and Allen Street.
The old Studebaker.
Right. It is now condos.
Right.
But it used to be a garage.
Right.
And they used to do plays in that space, but more importantly, it was their production area. It was their scene shop. And that's where they built scenery for Union Theater Productions. I don't know what that is. That's where they built scenery for their Union Theater Productions. And they used to truck everything back and forth on University Avenue. There are great stories about the theater people. Doug Taylor, who was like Fred Berkey's successor as the tech guy in the theater department, had a passion for wacko machinery. He had a forklift and other stuff, and he had this giant army bus where he cut away the entire frame of the housing of the bus. So all he had was the flatbed of the bus with a big bar down the middle and a driver's seat in front with, you know, nothing around. It was like a Bugs Bunny cartoon. There was a steering post that led into the ground and a seat with pedals sticking up, and otherwise it was just open. It was like a boat. And they would haul their scenery back and forth. Well, it was entertaining. It was a pain in the ass. And we're a theater department. Why don't we have a real home? Mm-hmm. Ultimately, they built Vilas Hall. It had problems, to say the least. But for better or for worse, it's been the home for the theater and drama department for the next 35 years now. Thoroughly inadequate for a variety of reasons. You said we could talk about private stuff that probably was best left and not unearthed until after all parties were dead. There was real breach between the old guard, Fred Berkey in particular, and the newcomers. And they felt they needed a clean break, and Fred really was the old world, and by then he was really curmudgeonly, and he was in his 70s anyway. But the fact is that Fred had no involvement, even though he was still on the faculty when the plans were being laid out, in the building of Vilas Hall, and particularly the theater facilities in Vilas Hall. Well, Fred Berkey and his partner in Milwaukee, Bob Brennan, as theater consultants, had a hand in the design and installation of countless theaters in high schools and colleges all over Wisconsin. They knew what they were doing. They knew how to build the theater from a production and technical standpoint. We're talking about loading docks and dressing room configurations and lighting system. Vintage 1950s, 60s, 70s, of course. Well, he had nothing to do with Vilas Hall. Okay. So now you have Vilas Hall, the Mitchell Theater, where the stage itself and the upstage is a triangle. Imagine that, a triangle, not even a backstage wall, where the two rehearsal rooms in Vilas Hall, which are the classrooms and studio space for drama classes and where they rehearse their productions, neither of the two studio spaces in Vilas Hall is big enough to duplicate the size of the stage in the Mitchell Theater, which means that when they tape the floor to block their plays, they can't block the scenery because the rooms where they have to rehearse are smaller than the stage they're going on to. I mean, really wacko things like that.
That seems like a pretty fundamental mistake.
Well, I don't know. You know, I was in and out. I was away from it much of the time. I was off in the Peace Corps during the early planning of Vilas Hall, and I wouldn't have been part of it anyway. But what I do know is that a lot of basic, fundamental, you must have this, you need that kind of stuff that anybody building theater facilities would know never got rolled into the Vilas Hall plans. And whether it was budget constraints or poor information or lack of knowledgeable input or whatever, the facilities that the speech department, theater and drama department moved into Vilas Hall were inadequate the day they moved in, and 36 years later they're still screaming for another space. And remember, the biggest catastrophe of all was that they never got their proscenium theater. So that big parking lot between University Square and Vilas Hall was where the proscenium theater was supposed to go, but I guess they ran out of money on that one. And so the theater department had a thrust stage, which was triangular in shape, and a black box, which is ultimately named the Helmsley Theater. And we used to joke and say when they needed to do real theater, and they needed a proscenium, guess what? They had to come back to the Union. So they walked out in a huff in 1970, and by the late 70s, they were back saying, well, you know, we need 2 weeks, 3 weeks to load in and build our set, and teach our students and do our productions. And they were surprised to find out that during the 8 or 10 years that they were gone, the Union Theater had in fact filled up the 5 slots a year with other programming that they needed to program in those spaces, and they didn't leave them sitting there vacant. This is telling you that we have a plan.
Oh.
And they didn't leave them sitting there vacant and empty, waiting for theater and drama to come back when it was convenient. So that over the years was there was a kind of undertow of irritation. You know, they needed a lot of time. They needed 2 weeks in the theater. They wanted 3. And Barry Robinson, of course, was the business manager for University Theater for many years, understood that the Union Theater couldn't basically shut down for 2.5, 3 weeks while the theater department, also they resented having to pay for the space. Remember, Wisconsin Union is, within the university, how it's self-financing.
This is side 2 of tape 5 of the continuing interview with Michael Goldberg, April 25th, 2006. Michael, I was starting to say, when the theater department came back in the late 70s, were you obligated to give them space?
We weren't obligated, but I mean, politically it would have been inappropriate not to. And, you know, really, the Union Theater was there to serve all users on campus who needed the Union Theater. The kind of proprietary claim that the theater and drama department had to the space had been diluted because of their years of absence. You know, they walked out, they took everything with them, and they went off to Vilas Hall, and when they got to Vilas Hall, they noticed that nobody had built the proscenium theaters, and they came back. And that kind of happened in the mid-70s. I remember I was away,
yeah,
74 to 77, 78. But they needed to be accommodated. But it was never easy, and they were never accommodated in the ways or to the extent that they felt they needed. And you know, and they didn't want to be there, but they had to be there, and it was not an easy business.
For all the years that I knew the theater department, all they could ever talk to me about was finding a donor to build them a proscenium theater.
So they never have to go back to the Union Theater again.
Apparently so.
Yeah. Yeah.
That was their, and there of course was no donor, right, who was going to write a $20 million.
Okay, so let's say that, unlike the University of Nebraska, who had a Johnny Carson or Dick Cavett, you see, nobody ever came out of the Union, out of the Wisconsin Theater and Drama Department that was a stupendous success. They had moderate successes. There were people who had careers who were very, very good. You know, the ones who come to mind, who are moving around now, Dan Travanti, Jane Kaczmarek, what's-her-face from L.A. Law, names escape me now, they'll come back. Well, it's kind of interesting because I came back to the Union Theater in 78 and I was there for the next 23 years. And every 3 to 5 years, either the new chair of the department or Barry would call up and say, well, we're trying to track down some of our alumni. Do you know any of them? Do you know any people who were, who went on to fame and fortune? I said, yeah, I know a few of them. But of course, people like Andre DeShields were pariahs when they were in the theater and drama department, and Stuart Gordon and those guys. They were the last people that the leadership of those departments wanted to have anything to do with,
right,
in the late 60s and early 70s. And of course, they're the ones who went on to real professional careers. Now, other things have changed since, but it was just kind of ironic that every few years somebody would call the Union Theater up and say, we're trying to track down famous and successful theater department alums. Can you think of any? You know, I don't know what keeps buzzing. But of course, we had all of the programs. I knew who all these people were, or at least I knew a lot of them because I'd been around so long, even though these people had moved on. But the people in the department didn't know who any of them were.
It's so interesting.
Yeah. Or if they did know, they didn't know how to find them. You know, they didn't know how to track them down. All right. So let me tell you the story that you know all too well, because it's so emblematic of the relationship. Right? I got a call from you when you were working in fundraising for Letters in Science, which included the Theater and Drama Department. It would have been around, I don't know, 1990 or so.
Mid-90s.
And you said to me, the theater department is trying to create a Lorraine Hansberry fellowship, endowed chair, so that annually they can bring in an African-American theater artist. So they're trying to raise money on Lorraine Hansberry's name. And Lorraine Hansberry went to the University of Wisconsin for a short period of time in the 50s. Which I didn't actually know, actually. I kind of knew her in the back of my brain somewhere. And you said to me that in her autobiography, she mentions an experience that she had on campus in Madison in the 50s. Do you know anything about that? So I very dutifully went across to the library and I pulled out a copy of her autobiography, Raising the Sun, it was called, same as her first play. And sure enough, on about page 55, she talks about being a student in Madison in the 1950s. Now, I gotta believe that being a black student from Chicago on the UW-Madison campus in the 1950s was not an easy thing, because it's not easy now. Right? But back then, you know, she might have been one of the seven black people in Madison, who knows? But she says that she remembered vividly a cold, gray day in February. She said, I can kind of paraphrase it, she said, and I wandered into the university theater with a small U, right, which I knew was the Union Theater. And apparently she walked in and she sits down and she watches a production of Sean O'Casey's Juno and the Peacock, which at that time was a relatively new play. It was only written, I think, in the late 40s or early 50s. And she comes out, and she said, when I left the theater, I knew what I was supposed to do with the rest of my life. So here was an apotheosis, you know, actually transformative moment for Lorraine Hansberry. And you said, do you know anything about this production? So I go poking. So I say, oh, I'll go upstairs and look in the files. So I go back through the Union Theater files, right? And I remembered there had been a production of Juno and the Peacock in the Union Theater in the 60s, which I had seen. But it was a touring production with the Abbey Theater in Dublin. And I knew that wasn't it. So I start going through all of the Wisconsin Players files for the 1950s that Fan Taylor had been hanging on to since 1939 and that were there waiting for me in 1996. And sure enough, I get to 1954, 55, whenever the hell it would have been, and I pull out the Wisconsin Players file for that season, and there are five productions, and one of them is a production of Sean O'Casey's Juno and the Peacock.
It's just astounding.
And I thought, bing, that must have been the show that she saw. So I called you up, and you said, I am going to New York to ask the people who administer the Lorraine Hansberry estate, essentially for permission to raise money in her name. Do you mind if I take a copy of this program with me? I said, well, there are four of them here. Why don't you give them one? And you can fill in the rest of the blanks. You went to them, and you said, look, I have an original document from the transformative moment in Lorraine Hansberry's life. And apparently they went, ah!
It's all I will add to Michael's story is that it is true. I had dinner with the widow who had married D. the man that Lorraine Hansberry married, after Lorraine died, he remarried, and she outlived him. Her name was Jewel, I think. Uh-huh. I had dinner with her and also the director of the theater division of the Ford Foundation, who was writing a biography of Lorraine Hansberry. And at dinner, at Doc Seafood on the Lower East Side, I gave them the program that you had found.
Right.
And it was an unbelievable moment. And for the record, I should note that a couple of years later, the Ford Foundation did come across with $100,000 for the Lorraine Hansberry Fellowship, for which, Michael, I think history should record our gratitude to you and Fan Taylor.
Yeah, well, and of course, I'm sure that they took that program and put it into their Lorraine Hansberry archives, because there it was, you know, it was her little Rosetta Stone of creativity. So that was just Fan keeping up her files. She wasn't throwing anything away. And there are many, many stories like that. I will tell you now another, which you may or may not be familiar with. The theater department, after they vacated the Union Theater, and for many years before, when I was still an undergraduate, used to do a student play festival, student play competition annually. They do a playwriting contest, right? And it was typically, recollection was usually a one-act play, but they did I think they produced some longer ones too. But very often these would be the plays that were directed by the MFA candidates and directors. Now, there was a kind of irony to that too, because I remember somebody, a graduate student, saying to me, "This is really stupid. The faculty is out here directing, you know, Ibsen and Edward Albee, and the graduate students are directing these student plays. You'd think that the really sophisticated and experienced faculty would be directing the new works, so correct, that students could get some practice directing the canon, right? But whatever. But anyway, they used to do playwriting compass, because I remember, because I used to do tech on those student play productions up in the play circle in the 60s and really into the 70s too. But then they stopped. They stopped doing play competition. It was a pain in the ass, you know. Play competitors were coming from all over campus. They were, you know, every student on campus, you know, every third student on campus had a one-act play in his or her desk drawer. You know, they would enter them every year. So the department stopped doing those. I don't know why or when exactly. You'd have to ask them. But in about a few years after this Lorraine Hansberry business, I got a call again from somebody at UW Foundation, John something with an S.
I don't know.
And he calls me up and he says, "We've come across an alum who lives in California, who has some interest in student plays, student playwriting." He says, "Apparently this woman, when she was a student, wrote a play that was produced in Madison. And this woman's name is Marcia Legere Binns, B-I-N-N-S. Okay? So I very dutifully climbed the stairs to this little back closet up there, and now I'm poking through all the Wisconsin Players files from the 1940s. And I asked a little bit about who this woman was. Well, her married name was Binns, B-I-N-N-S. But for many years, she was married to a Hollywood actor named Ed Binns. Now, you may have heard of his name, and you couldn't picture him if you sit there and tried. But if you were watching any one of dozens of episodes of Ponderosa or TV stuff and any number of Hollywood movies, his most prominent role, as I recall, he had a role in Thoroughly in the Americanization of Emily, which was an early Julie Andrews film. And he also In the Henry Fonda film version of 12 Angry Men, he played juror number 6. Right? Huh. So I tracked down Ed Binns because I find him on the internet media database, internet movie database. And Marsha Legere is his wife. And he died a few years before. He'd had a long, very successful Hollywood career. He'd make gazillions of dollars. He wasn't a big star, but he was a very successful actor. And Marsha Legere is living out there in Santa Monica or someplace. And somehow the university had found out that she was connected. Well, it turns out that I think the connection is that she's actually a very, very close friend of Joe Melly, who's an attorney here in town, is on the he's on the board of the museum here, and is connected to the university too. They went to school together. So I'm up there looking for anything about this. And sure enough, about 1947, I find the file for the Wisconsin Players Productions for that year. And the third production, or the fourth production of the year, was a three-act play by Marsha Legere, who it turns out was an undergraduate in the 40s and had written a play, which wasn't a student production. As far as I could tell, it was one of the five main productions that the speech department did that year. Now, a little backtracking here. In the late 80s, I had a union directorate chair. I can see her now, I can't remember her name. She was a music major. And she created a student composition contest. Well, composition contests just didn't work. We had student composers on campus, but there weren't all that many of them. And it was really hard to play the work, and couldn't get musicians, and the students weren't skilled enough to play the repertoire. So about 3 years after this gal, I can see her, you'll come back to me, after she graduated, one of the committee members transformed it into the student playwriting competition. And this was a student on the committee, not the chair, named Todd Bachman, who I believe now actually works as a producer for Ira Glass, for This American Life. I hear his name in the credits all the time. But Todd kind of turned the old composition contest into a student playwriting festival. Right? So for about 5 years before this call about Marsha Legere had come, my student programmers had annually been producing a student playwriting competition, and where they would produce and they would stage 3 one-act plays every spring. So I find the play, and your successor there at the foundation says, "Oh my God, you know, she really did write this play." And I think, you know, she said, "Well, I would be interested in a donation to the university if it was supportive of student playwriting." So he takes this to the theater department. "Oh, no, we don't do that anymore." So he comes back to
Really?
"Oh, yeah. We don't do that anymore. I think they do something like that at the union." So he comes to me. And that's why he found me in the first place. And I said, "Oh, well, in fact, the union directorate produces the student play festival every year. Cost them, I don't know, it costs about $3,000. It's pretty kind of shoestring effort there. And nobody's really paid. Production expenses. I think we do the whole thing for $3,000-$4,000, and $300-$400 of that is prizes. You know, $150 and $75 to the playwrights." And the upshot of it is that they pitch the whole thing to Marsha Legere, and she and I have some correspondence back and forth. And she makes a commitment, and over 3 or 4 years, she donates a few thousand here, a few thousand there, and we end up with. I think it was, in the end, it was about $50,000.
Really?
Which, on an interest-earning basis, was just about enough to pay for the festival.
Right.
So we changed the name to the Marsha Legere Student Playwriting Competition, and every year I would dutifully send her a program, and I'd tell her, you know, these were the three plays, and tell her a little bit about what each play was, and we had correspondence back and forth. And finally, after about 4 or 5 years, Marsha, who is in her 60s now, maybe early 70s, comes to Madison to visit. And she couldn't come during the play festival, although we kept writing her. And Marsha, she's really nice. She's a little eccentric, you know, a little quirky. She says, "Oh, I can do my email, but I keep forgetting. I'm going to be in Hawaii next weekend." But we stayed in communication. It was very, very nice, very cordial. And indeed, one day in the spring, I actually pick her up at Joe Melly's house out on Lake Monona. She gets handed off to me by, what's her name at the foundation?
Marion Brown.
Marion. Marion said, would you show Marcia around? So I show Marcia around the campus. It was a sentimental visit for Marcia. Marcia hasn't been on campus since she was a student, which was 45 years ago, right? So we go to the Union, I show her the play circle, show her the Union Theater. She said, this is where they did my play. I said, right. You know. And we have lunch with Marion at,
at the
Admiralty, at the Edgewater, right? So the upshot of it is that Marcia, ultimately, we pitch projects at her. And ultimately, I think she finally signs off on an estate gift, not now, but later, of, as I understand it, you'd have to go back and check me on this, but I believe that she commits to an estate gift of $250,000, the earnings from which would be used annually to bring to campus a living playwright whose work, man or woman, was going to be produced by the department during that year, so that that playwright could be on campus in the week run-up to his or her play being performed.
Oh, the Department of Theater and Drama had to.
Right. Yeah, so we did a little thing for them. Now, I don't know how it's actually going to play out, and I don't know the details of the agreement, but the concept was a visiting playwright, living playwright, whose work was going to be done here. I got this idea because the rep had been doing, did an Arthur Miller play a few years ago, and they brought Arthur Miller in. No, it would Edward Albee play. And they brought Albee in for a week, so he was part of the publicity, and they went up to the show, and they talked about the play. And that's kind of where I got the idea, and I thought, well, great. The Union does a lecture series, so the Forum kids who do the lecture series can have this playwright do a talk on the lecture series, and the playwright can talk to the theater and drama majors. It's a living playwright. You know, and if it's all about women, if it's a Wendy Wasserstein who died just a couple of months ago, they could talk to the Women's Studies Department and so on. So that was the concept. It was a living playwright would come to campus, and Marcia ultimately signed off on an estate gift that's going to pay for that program.
God, Michael, that's just wonderful.
Yeah.
That's just wonderful. Congratulations.
Well, there it is.
Thank you.
Well, you're welcome. No, it was an honor to do it. So you know, and that was because Fan kept the files, right? There they all were. And I got to tell you, every 5 years I would call up, the room was really crowded, and I'd say, Barry, we have all these Wisconsin players' files up here. Do you want them? He said, no, I can't. They just get sent over to the Steenbach Library. We don't know where to put them. They get lost. You hang on to them. I said, fine, I'll hang on to them. So we still have them. Ralph Russo has all
their files. Still at the Union?
They're still upstairs at the Union. And Ralph Russo, I said to Ralph, whatever you do, protect these files. They are not in great shape, they are not in glassine whatevers, but there they are. And I'll give you another story, also about the files. Because these are not just stories, they are emblematic.
Oh, you bet.
Of what the theater was.
Right.
Remember, this was a space like Lorraine Hansberry, like Marcia.
Yes.
Where events happened that were transformative in their lives. And remember, doing a theater production at the Union Theater for the speech majors was curricular, but for almost everybody else, like myself, it was an extracurricular activity. I wasn't a theater major. I just spent a life in the Union Theater. I always said about this university that it was a big university. Kids would come to campus, and when I first came, it was either the dormies or the private houses or they were the Jewish liberals, communists from New York. but my experience on this campus was, because it was a big campus, students kind of found little enclaves of safety for themselves.
Yes.
Some of them found them over at the Daily Cardinal and in the journalism school. That was where they hung out. Some of them found their dwelling in athletics.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them found it with the marching band in the School of Music. Well, a lot of kids found their home in the Union. And a different clutch of us found our home in the theater, in the Union Theater. So students have a way of finding their safe havens in the university environment. The Union Theater was that for many, many people. And for me, as you know from my other stories, it really basically imprinted what my life was supposed to be about. So anyway, one day I get a visit from Sandra Adell, who is faculty member in African American Studies. And she says to me, I am writing a paper, I'm writing something about Paul Robeson. And somebody told me that Paul Robeson had appeared at this university at some time. So do you know anything about that? So I dutifully lead Sandy Adell upstairs to the storeroom where we have all these files, right? Now I knew, there are a lot of pieces to this story, I knew for a variety of reasons that Paul Robeson had been in the Union Theater several times. Paul Robeson, for anybody listening to this who doesn't know, is one of the premier African-American figures of the second half, middle and second half of the 20th century. Mm. He was almost a non-person when J. Edgar Hoover and the FBI got finished with him.
Right.
Because of his communist leanings, he was vilified, they did everything they could to destroy his career, they did everything, it was only 1984, they did what they could to erase him.
Mm-hmm.
But he was an enormously successful student athlete. He was a black man. His father, I think, was a minister, and he played football for Rutgers University when he was growing up in New Jersey in the 30s. He was a very, very successful athlete.
I did not know that.
Then he had a tremendous career as a singer.
Mm-hmm.
And although he was remembered as famously for singing spirituals, kind of like Marian Anderson, he was a serious classical singer. Right? And he was an actor. Paul Robeson appeared at the Union Theater about five times.
Hmm.
And before the Union Theater opened, he had actually done a recital on a concert series.
Oh.
And you can keep it rolling. I'm going over to pick up my copy of Fan Taylor's book because it has all the theater dates of performances from the time the theater opened. But I went back and tried to fill in the concert series stuff from before the time that the theater opened. Remember, the concert series went back to 1920.
Right.
But Robeson was bass baritone, spirituals only. Stock Pavilion, December 10th, 1929.
Really?
February 14th, 1933. And then October 21st in the Union Theater, 1940. And that was all in the concert series. But Robeson was also, and he also appeared on the concert series in January of 46. But Paul Robeson was also in a very, very famous production of Othello, where he played Othello opposite Uta Hagen as Desdemona. And Uta, of course, was from Madison. Uta Hagen's father, Oscar Hagen, was one of the founders of the art history department. If you walk into the Elvian Museum, there's a big portrait of Oscar Hagen in one of those rooms. And Uta played Desdemona. Here is a picture of Uta Hagen coming onto campus with her father Oscar here in May of 1949.
Right.
Right. And the Iago in that production was
Jose Ferrer.
Correct. And that was a very famous production of Othello. Well, it didn't tour extensively in the United States, but it did play the Wisconsin Union Theater. And upstairs in that office full of files is a file for that production, that touring production.
Really?
And there are pictures, there are production pictures of I'm trying to look for the actual picture, but there were production pictures of that Othello. All right. So Paul Robeson had a lot of history at the Union Theater and at Wisconsin. So we go upstairs, And Sandy and Idell and I are poking through the files, and I'm looking for the Paul Robeson files, because remember, we don't only have the Union Theater files, but we have the concert series files going back to 1920.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So I'm poking along there, and she says to me, "What's that?" And I said, "Well, that's Duke Ellington, who was in the Union Theater in the 1970s. And then I'm poking through the files, and she said, "What's that?" And I say, "Well, that's Marian Anderson's concert on campus in 1939. I said, "And what's that?" And I said, "Well, that's the Martin Luther King smoking. He spoke in the Union Theater." And I said, "And what's that?" And that's, "Well, that's Count Basie, and that's Miles Davis, and that's..." And it turns out that the Union Theater, through Fan's era and on through the 60s and 70s and 80s, presented not every, but almost every really important African-American artist — at that time they were all called Negroes —
uh-huh,
who ever toured, including Louis Armstrong and Ella Fitzgerald and all the rest of them.
How interesting.
And what's interesting about that, of course, is that Fan did not present these artists because she had a mandate for diversity.
Uh-huh.
She presented these artists in the 40s and 50s because she had a mandate for doing great touring and performing artists, including,
right,
the Pro-Arty Quartet and everybody else who was on tour in the 30s and 40s and 50s. Here's this production of Othello, this picture of Paul Robeson with Jose Ferrar right behind him as Iago.
Wow.
Okay. In other words, the Union Theater hosted almost every really important black artist who toured in theater and music in the 40s and 50s, from the time it opened, really. Because Marian Anderson was there in 1939, the year the theater opened, because she didn't actually sing in the theater. They had to put her in the stock building because the audience was so big.
That was the same year, wasn't it, that the DAR, 1939?
Declined to let her sing.
Declined to let her.
At Constitution Hall, so the president said, "Great, you'll sing in front of the Washington Monument."
This is tape number 6, side 1, Michael Goldberg, April 25th, 2006.
And we were just saying that Marian Anderson appeared on the Union Concert Series in 1939, the year that the DAR, who controlled Constitution Hall in Washington at the time, refused to let her sing there.
Right.
Because she was a Negro. Eleanor Roosevelt arranged for her to sing on the Mall instead.
Yes.
Well, actually, she was supposed to be on the concert series in the inaugural year of the concert series in the Union Theater. But of course, the demand was so enormous that they moved the concert to the Stock Pavilion. And the Cardinal wrote something about, "Well, the Union Theater paint isn't dry on the walls, and they've already had to move out of it." This fan was always amused by that. But anyway, so Sandy Adell sees all these files for all these African-American artists. And the upshot of it is that she takes on a graduate student. And why can't I remember his name? Rutledge. Wonderful guy. Just graduated. Just finished up his PhD. And he comes upstairs and does a little delving into the African-American artist files. And she creates an extension course called African American Artists at the Wisconsin Union Theater.
Really? I didn't know Sandy did that.
Yeah. She only did
oh,
it for
cool.
She only did it for I think she did it once. I think it was part of a summer extension program. But there it was, you know. And I think that the most telling thing that came out of that is what I said before, that all those black artists in the Union Theater were not there because they were black. They were there because they were artists. And this comes back to Sfan's mantra about only the best, only the best. She didn't bring in Miles Davis or Count Basie because they were black artists. She brought them in because they were the best artists doing what they did. And that was for the folkies too, Josh White and those guys.
Yeah.
Everything she did was, who are the great artists performing today? And if they happened to be black, they were there. And so the record of diverse programming, if you go on an ethnicity count, at the Union Theater is simply unprecedented. And I would argue that it carried the banner for that kind of multicultural awareness, which obviously it wasn't called in the 30s and 40s and 50s, kind of in a way for the entire university. In fact, there's this wonderful story, they're also in here, about the Leonard DePauw Singers. Leonard DePauw was had been an airman in the Second World War. And after the war, he had a singing group of black airmen. They used to dress in their uniforms. And they did a concert on the Union Concert Series, Leonard DePauw Singers. And the next day, they went down, I don't know, it was Racine or Kenosha or someplace in the corner of the state. And this was in the 50s, like I can tell you the data, just have to look in the book, right? And Fan is very fond of telling the story that they did a concert here, and then the next day they went down to do this other date in Wisconsin, and he called Leonard DePauw Infantry Chorus, February 12, 1948, November 1 and 2, 1950, on the concert series. And I don't know which one of these was, but apparently, I think she actually references this in the book. She says that they were down there, and they couldn't get out. They couldn't find a hotel. There was a choir of black infantrymen, and they wouldn't let them stay at the hotel. In must have been Racine County or Kenosha County. So Fan said, "Well, Mr. DePauw, you and your choir just come back up here. We'll make arrangements, and we'll get your hotel here in Mass." So, and we're not talking about 1930. We're talking about 1950.
Right.
Well, actually. 1950. So, that's quite a story.
It is actually astounding.
Yeah. But the point about this is that the theater itself was a host environment for every conceivable kind of performance and other activity. But the stellar stuff and the headliner names and the famous artist stuff is really where, you know, it's all the glamour is, you know, the H.C.O. Pinses and the Yasha Heifetzes and all the rest of it, and the Martha Grahams and the Ballet Russe. And, you know, I mean, there's just nothing in the way of famous music, dance, and theater people of the 1940s and 50s and 60s that didn't play in the Union Theater. It was it. Now, today, campuses all over the country have performing arts centers. I mean, you know, the Krannert Center in Hampshire and Iowa City and Zellerbach out in Berkeley and all the rest of them. And all campuses had some kind of performance venue of some kind. It was either the chapel or the assembly hall or whatever. But the Union Theater, in the context of the Porter Butts model of a learning laboratory for arts and creativity. And remember the galleries and the workshops and craft shops upstairs and Hoofers downstairs fit into that. And then Fan, given that opportunity with the Union Theater, created program of absolutely the highest conceivable order of quality. It was exemplary. And it was exemplary for all the right reasons. And so the generations of students who passed through that theater, the Barbara Manleys, who was a theater chair, mm-hmm. and the Frank Manley, who was an usher, mm-hmm. experienced the Union Theater as an environment for cultural experience of the very highest level. And remember, these students got to shake hands with these artists. Mm-hmm. They got to greet them at the airport. They got to take him out to dinner afterwards. It was miraculous. And needless to say, you know, the Walt Pankos and the Barbara Manleys of the world remember that.
Absolutely.
Because it happened to them. And they're, so, you know, when people at the foundation, people like Bonnie Bruce and the rest of them, are always astonished at the sense of I mean, UW alums love their university.
Right.
But nobody loves them the way these Union alums do.
I think, but that's true for you, Michael.
Absolutely.
I think you love the union.
Absolutely.
The union theater and the union.
And the university, too.
Yes.
But that university experience, that union experience is so emblematic for so many generations of students of orders concept and fans leadership.
Yeah.
And between them, and so when I have to write copy, I use all kinds of cliches, you know, about serving audiences, artists, and the arts for 50 years. Right?
Mm-hmm.
But that's what they did. They did it in the service of the audiences, students in particular,
mm-hmm.
the artists themselves. Fan always said, you treat them like a guest in your home. And by the way, you expect them to behave like a guest in your home.
Oh, that's interesting.
And the arts themselves. And the mantra was quality, quality, quality. Now, this is my soapbox, but I've told you why quality is so important.
Yeah.
Here's the deal. You got university students, some of them for big cities, some of them for small towns. Majority of them may never have seen a dance event in their lives.
Mm-hmm.
So you get them to come to the Union Theater to see a dance company. Ultimately, the art has to stand on its own merits.
Mm-hmm.
But you come to a university to learn and experience new stuff, and you get a kid in to watch a performance. Well, if you put out a great, great dance concert, and they take a look and they say, as my father used to say, well, if that's contemporary dance, I'll take vanilla. Not my thing, fine. But if you put out a mediocre company, you put out a crappy performance, and the student walks away and says, it's not for me, then you've done a terrible disservice to the artist, to the student, and to the art itself.
Right.
Because if you do the best and it fails to win you over, say, fine, chamber music is never going to be my thing. But if I give you third-rate chamber music and ask you to make a judgment on that basis, and you walk away and you say, yeah, I'll pass, then you've really cheated everybody. That's why quality matters.
Michael, and is the commitment to quality and the potential for transformative experiences still happening?
I certainly hope so. At least where the concert series was concerned, I took that very, very seriously, although it was kind of a losing battle, because, you know, chamber music is a tough sell under any circumstances. We won over a few, but basically we just kept the ones who were already there. But at least as far as the concert series is concerned, I think Ralph is doing a great job. He and I talk about it from time to time. I can't really meddle in his programming, but before I went away, I tried to tell Ralph, who by his own admission really is not very knowledgeable at all in the classical music game, but understands that it is a central element of Union Theater programming. But I tried to steer him to the places, the sources of artists, and honorable managers who would ensure, you know, if you shop in a place that only sells quality produce, you're less likely to buy inferior product.
Yes.
So he's been very
That's
successful.
Good advice.
But more to the point is that the theater itself still operates as a committed showcase environment, not only for student experience, but for student involvement with the arts. And Ralph comes to the booking conferences now, and he actually brings more students to the conferences than I used to bring. So I think that commitment is ongoing. I certainly hope it is, and I can't imagine it's not, because remember, the underpinning for the whole thing, once again, is Porter's philosophy and fans' approach, and that certainly continues to be central to what the union does. I think one of the very regrettable things about the Wisconsin Union is that it's dominant presence in the life of the university, not just in the theater itself, but in all aspects of campus life. I don't think it's diminished. I just think that the campus itself has gotten so much bigger and much more complex all around it that the union is just not as prominent a player as it always was. It's still pretty central. I mean, remember the union administers the WIS cards.
Right.
Right. So every student's debit card is managed by the union. But in terms of its being, you know, a high profile element in the lives of the student body. When I was an undergraduate, there were 20,000 students on campus.
Mm-hmm.
Now there are 40,000 students on campus. During these glory years of programming in the Union Theater, the 40s and 50s and early 60s, there weren't even that many. You know? So as the campus got bigger and bigger, the numbers of students that could be seriously connected to the union, I don't know how that's grown or diminished, but obviously it certainly hasn't grown. It hasn't doubled and tripled the way the university has. Nevertheless, those experiences in the Union Theater, very, very powerful. I have to finish up a little bit on Paul Robeson because it really kind of matters to me. Greg Rutledge was his name. This was the graduate student who worked for Sandy Adell, who I think finally finished up with a joint PhD in literature and Afro-American studies, but I'm not sure. He just went off to take a job last year. He got married, he had a baby, and he and his wife left Madison. He had a long graduate career, a very successful graduate career, and apparently he was a lawyer before he came to study at the university.
Oh.
A pre-law, I don't know what he was, from Atlanta he was. And he had never, when I first met him, and he was doing this work for Sandy, he didn't really know who Paul Robeson was.
Really?
He had heard of him, but he really didn't have a clue. So I gave him a copy of my biography of Paul Robeson that I worked off of, and you know, he familiarized himself with, I remember him referring to him once as, in an email, Greg was a Southerner, he grew up in a Southern household, so he was kind of formal sometimes in his emails. And he sent me a thank you note and said, well, I said, keep the book. And he said, well, thank you for introducing me to this important African-American artist. It was very funny. I really liked the guy. But anyhow, and this is a personal sidebar, but it turns out that in the early 70s, there was a play written about Paul Robeson.
Oh, really?
It was a two-person show. It was a one-person vehicle for Paul Robeson, and then there was a guy who played the piano who was on stage through the entire piece. And the character of Paul Robeson, basically it was a kind of biographical presentation of his life, including singing. And the play was originally written in the early 70s and done in New York. And I do believe it was James Earl Jones who played the Paul Robeson part.
Really?
The play was something of a cause célèbre. Paul Robeson has a son who was very protective of his father's legacy. Oh. And he denounced this play as being not representative of who his father is or was. Right? And a lot of leading African Americans at the time, including, I believe, Mary Baraka, at the urging of Paul Robeson's son, kind of spoke negatively about the play, many of whom never saw it. It was really quite a controversial thing.
Huh.
I read some reviews of this. So you cut forward for about 8 or 9 years to the late 70s, early 80s. It turns out that one of the problems with the production was that James Earl Jones just wasn't a singer. He was a great actor, great voice, but he wasn't much of a singer. And you had to stand there and sing, which is what Paul Robeson did, you know, including Old Man River,
right,
which is pretty damn hard to sing.
Yeah.
Well, it turns out that the stage production rights for this play ended up belonging to Avery Brooks.
Really?
Avery Brooks is the guy who played Captain What's-His-Name on Star Trek, the Deep Space Nine.
Yeah.
Avery Brooks is also the guy who played Hawk in the television series about Spencer, the Robert Parker sleuth. And Hawk is really quite a character. Well, Avery Brooks is a terrific actor. And Avery Brooks is a great singer. Avery Brooks's mother was an opera singer. And Avery Brooks, who grew up in New Jersey and teaches at Rutgers and works in Hollywood, turns out to own the performance rights to this play about Paul Robeson. And for years, I wanted to make the show happen at the Union Theater because of the connection to Paul Robeson. And finally, in the 90s, I'd have to look up the dates. I don't think it's actually in here because Fan's book stops in 1989.
Yeah.
I talked to the producer, because Avery Brooks wasn't touring. You know, he had other work to do. But every few years, he would get a week-long sit-down where he would do this Paul Robeson piece. And one of the
things, he was continuing to perform
it. He would perform the part that James Earl Jones had performed in. Right? And one of the interesting things about this, of course, is that 10, 12, 14, 15 years later, nobody had a problem with the play. And Avery Brooks was fond of pointing out, nothing changed. The script was exactly the same. So it wasn't the representation of Paul Robeson that was problematic. It was people's point of view on that representation. But anyway, it finally turned out that the producer, I bugged him for a few years, and he tells me that, in fact, they're going to do a week run of Avery Brooks and this Paul Robeson piece in Chicago. And we work it out for a fee that on a Monday night, he and his pianist, Ernie, I can't remember his last name, come up to Madison, and they do the Paul Robeson show in the Union Theater.
Really?
Small audience, but it made me very, very happy, because there was some closure.
How wonderful. Yeah. Was it a wonderful performance?
It was a great performance. And Avery Brooks really could sing Old Man River. So it was great fun.
This concludes this portion of the interview on April 25th, 2006.